The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So we might say that as we grow in this practice, as we develop along two registers. We develop in terms of depth, the Dharma penetrating more deeply, but also breadth, the Dharma filling out different corners of our lives. And I think, you know, in general, in Buddhist circles, we primarily think of practice as the depth dimension. Maybe that's not fair, but I think in probably less so actually here at IMC, but in a lot of places where I've practiced, progress is largely equated with the deepening, meaning that the Dharma penetrates more deeply, the mind settles in more deeply to the present moment. We have greater and greater access to intense love and openness and fearlessness. We feel connected, rooted to something deep, and different kinds of awareness become accessible to us, and states that we didn't know existed when we started practicing, states of well-being and open-heartedness, undefendedness. This may be, we could say, is one register of practice. This is the depth. And when anybody talks about enlightenment or emptiness, or this is the, they're pointing to the depth dimension. Yeah. But then there's also this breadth. And what I mean by that is that these teachings start to colonize more and more corners of our life. That less and less of our minds and behaviors and emotions, less and less of our history is kind of protected from the eye of Dharma and awareness. And so there's a sense of the Dharma is like, it's like spreading. It spreads into places that we hadn't planned for it to spread to. You know, those last like bastions of unconsciousness that are protected, you know, we protect from the Dharma. More and more the practice starts to fill in like water running into crevices or something. And so we're becoming more and more transparent to ourselves. More and more there's a process of softening and opening. And in this process, it's of course, we're doing it for ourselves. We want to feel like our own inner life is safe. But this is also how we become safe for others. The safety that we can offer to others is more a function of the breadth, I would say, rather than depth. Right? Because we don't harm each other from awareness. That's not how we do our harm in the world. You know, really comes out of places where the teachings haven't soaked into. And so in some ways, I think of it as a kind of moral imperative to know ourselves, to allow the Dharma to seep into different corners of our life, because it's that process that actually makes us safer and safer for others. And I, you know, I've had different intentions in my practice and different wishes, and but something that I heard really early in practice that was very, it was this phrase, it was quite moving for me, and it was something like the intention to be a kind of refuge for others, to be safe for others. And this is not in the context of being a Dharma teacher or anything like that. This is just as a practitioner or a person, you know. How safe are we for others? And what's the process by which we become really safe? Now there's a sense that perhaps at some point we can stop this process of letting the Dharma stop looking for places for the Dharma to soak into. Yeah? And that's enlightenment or... But I don't know. I prefer the model where we never stop looking for ways the Dharma can soak more deeply into our lives, and we never stop looking for the places that are unsaturated by Dharma. And so tonight, I want to put that as a kind of preamble. Talk about secrets and freedom, transparency. And, you know, this is... I mean, it's always the case to sort of take what's said, I don't know, with a grain of salt. Maybe that's a little dismissive, but these are, you know, things to test out, of course. But tonight, maybe even more so, because I can feel the idiosyncrasies of my conditioning very alive in this talk. So secrets. This is something you could say that maybe we think about secrets as something that we hide from others. But the status of secrets within ourselves is they're partially obscured from ourselves. There's a little sense of like we don't have, they're a little hidden from ourselves, yeah? Or we keep them that way. And there's often this kind of dance of between sort of opening up to some of that material and moving back into being maybe more dismissive of it or just really putting it aside. And you see this in sometimes in people who really can kind of move from one place to feeling like, oh, this is a theme in my life. This is my. I need to open with this. This needs my heartfelt attention, to sort of bracketing it and putting it aside. Yeah. And you know, we live in a culture that is very, very moralistic about what it's like to be human, about the standards that what humans should be like. There's a lot of moralism of what we're supposed to feel and experience and be and look like, and so it promotes a kind of hiding in ways. So this is Rochefoucauld. We're so accustomed to disguise ourselves to others that in the end we become disguised to ourselves. Now, I'm in talking about secrecy, you know, and the secrets that we have. Secrecy, I want to distinguish that from privacy. Yeah, there may be lots of good reasons to be private about lots of things. Yeah, we may not want to share. You know, and it's important actually to regulate what we share. There's sometimes people. Sometimes people say too much to me, more than I want, more than they want, you know. And some level of kind of privacy and monitoring that's not what I'm talking about. That may be totally appropriate. This is something that a kind of material that's kind of embedded in some kind of shame, maybe, or material that we're not letting really breathe in our consciousness. Now, this theme around secrets, it intersects with a lot of important themes in the Dharma, like honesty and equanimity, non-avoidance, truth-telling. This is, I'm quoting him a lot lately. This is Sam Harris again, who wrote a book on lying. When you give yourself the out of lying, you deny yourself the kinds of collisions with reality that are necessary to improve your life. A commitment to honesty is a mirror you hold up to yourself where you can discover who you are in relation to others and in relation to your moment-to-moment experience. Yeah. So we can, to see what is secret in our life is to learn important things about who we think we are. Sometimes I've had this idea that admittedly a strange idea. But what would it be like to have, you know, like reality TV shows? What would it be like? It would not be a highly rated show, but what would it be like to be like Dharma teacher reality TV, except you don't know, I don't know that I'm on, you know, that I'm part of this production or whatever. Like, and I actually use that as like this strange little tool to think about what is it that I don't feel comfortable disclosing. What is it? What is outside of, like, this role to me is about a deep transparency. Like, to come together in Dharma is about a deep transparency. Again, not sharing everything, but a sense of I don't want there to be anything that I have to protect. And so imagining this, 24/7 camera, I get to see when I would want to shut that camera off, yeah? And, you know, when is that? Why is that? What goes on? What is it that's happening for me in those moments when there's something, if there's something I don't want to disclose or share? Why is there self-consciousness about it? And I'll share a couple different reasons why there may be self-consciousness in a moment. But it's good to see that this whole process is, it to keep a secret is stressful. It's stressful. And it's stressful for some of the same reasons that it's stressful to try to control our minds or our hearts, you know, to control what arises in thought and emotion. This is a researcher who is best known for research on thought suppression. So what happens? So don't think of a pink elephant. Right? That doesn't go well, yeah? Because we are sort of scanning, you know, first we identify what we're not supposed to think of, right? And then we're like scanning the mental terrain to see if there are any pink elephants, yeah? But we bring that pink elephant into being in that very vigilant guarding against its arising, yeah? It doesn't work so well. So anyway, this is Wegner says, keeping our thoughts to ourselves is not easy. Secrecy is an active process as it requires much deliberate behavioral and mental work. At times, it seems that the more we try to hide something, the more likely we are to reveal that very thing. The cognitive maneuvers necessary for keeping a secret create an intentional suppression of the secret thought, the consequence of which is a preoccupation with the secret itself. So, one of the kind of enduring, rumbling anxieties of life is that we could be found out. You know, there's a sense of like we could be found out. Yeah. And to be able to live in a way where we don't feel like we could be found out, to feel transparent in a way, you know, not that we, you know, are perfectly at peace or at peace with ourselves, but to feel like the heart is open to all of our life. That the secrets, that there are no secrets that are being fully protected from awareness and open-heartedness. Now, the secrets that we hold, sometimes the audience for that secret is, it may be imaginary. It might be a person who's not alive. But we can learn a lot from, like, if we ask the question, like, from whom are we keeping this secret? Like, what is it that propels us to do that? what feelings would we need to be exposed to in revealing something? Yeah. And what can we learn about self-judgment and the ways we may be very harsh with ourselves around secrets based on that audience, those people that we're keeping this from, real or imagined? We can learn a lot, like, who are we keeping this from? And what are we afraid they will think, do, say? What can we learn about where we're most identified as being this or not being that? I am like this. I am a person who's like this. I am a person who's not like that. Yeah. So why do we keep secrets? To me, it's largely a function of something in the neighborhood of shame, you know. And shame might, the way I was been thinking about it is, it might arise two different kinds of shame: the Buddhist kind of shame, and then the, you know, convicting ourselves for crimes we didn't commit, that kind of shame. So, one form of secret can be that our conduct is out of alignment with our, you know, deepest intentions. That we can feel there's something we're doing that doesn't feel right, is causing harm in some way, and it doesn't, it feels, we want to really put it aside because it feels out of step with what we want in life, what our values are. And this is, you know, this is sometimes translated as shame, but This has a kind of, that kind of concern has a revered place within Buddhism. You know, we almost always have very negative associations with the word shame, and I'm not even sure shame is the best word for this, but this is one of the guardians of the world. Hiri and Otapa. So, this is the Buddha. There are two bright qualities that safeguard the world. Which two? Hiri and Otapa. Conscience and concern for the results of unskillful actions. If these two bright qualities did not guard the world, there would be no recognition of mother here, no recognition of mother's sister, and then goes on and on. And it's a very interesting way to put that, no recognition of mother. Without this sense of some aversion to unskillful action, without that sense of some, quote, shame, the Buddha's suggesting that it would break down kind of basic social fabric of our society. You know, if there were no aversive response to deviating from sila, that would be a kind of destructive force in the world. That we wouldn't know mother exactly as mother in the same way. We wouldn't know all of these relationships in the same way. And so, you know, on this side, like, some of our secrets are around conduct that we feel is inconsistent. And you know, behavior changes slowly. Yeah. That is one of the enduring lessons, you know, of behavioral science, is that the behavior changes slowly, but it's changeable. And some of our practice is, I would say, is sort of clarifying the view. Like when I've seen pieces of my conduct that like doesn't quite feel right, I'm often in a kind of limbo zone for a while, partially acknowledging it, but partially not. A little bit secretive from my own mind. And part of the process is actually bringing that out into the light of day, like this, not letting delusion kind of reign and obscure anything, feeling the discomfort actually of being a little out of step with what we want. And then, you know, in those moments sometimes we'll make, okay, I want to change. I'm going to do everything different. But from what I can see, much more useful to be very deliberate, very gradual, do little kind of behavioral experiments and kind of almost flirt with behavioral change and see what happens. One other point which is that it can be good to have like plan B with sila related behavior change. Plan B, very kind of specific steps for how change happens. See, we have these mind moments of really intense intention, yeah? And so maybe it's I'm quitting smoking, or I'm meditating every day, or whatever it may be. And it's like it may be really intense in that moment. Or I'm never eating at McDonald's again, but you just finished eating at McDonald's. Yeah, and so we sort of overestimate the meaning of one mind moment. And it's really a sort of sustained, continuous nourishing of an intention that's associated with change in behavior. So this is one kind of, one side. But then the other side, and maybe a more closer to our heart, are all the kinds of shame that are clearly unproductive. You know, and this is, you know, like we can look to see, like, how did something in our life become secret? How did that actually happen? And what were the kind of emotional flavors involved in that? And a lot of time it does come back to, to something that we are convicting ourselves of something we had no control over, or something that we just didn't understand at the time. We were overwhelmed by something. Yeah. And this process is, the necessity of kindness around this kind of work and unpacking is can't really be underestimated. It's like oxygen, you know, to begin to sort of like air out these corners of the mind or corners of our history, or it's like we need the audience, and that audience in this case is our own mind. Yeah, we need the audience to be wide open and spacious. So open that just there is no place for judgment to arise. Shame, you know, is an interpersonal affect. It emerges usually with a real other or imagined other. And so I think a lot of the healing, too, is actually interpersonal in nature. That we actually, part of the function of Sangha, of community, is seeing, you know, of like really feeling how deeply we share this human condition. You know, and to be in a community and space where we're actually really open about what it's like to be alive. You know? And when a community can be really open to what it's like and share openly about that, we can start to sense just how much we share with other people. We, you know, for all of the differences at the level of pleasure and pain, at the level of our attention, there's so much that's shared. And so, through the practice, we start to drain some of the emotional, affective charge from these areas of the mind. It's like the awareness is slowly seeping into those corners. And maybe images and thoughts and feeling comes up, and we like actually have the chance to digest some of that on the cushion. We're opening to the basic vulnerability of being human and the helplessness associated with shame. It's a psychoanalyst, Adam Phillips, wrote something like, you know, we don't grow out of the vulnerability of being a child. It's more like we grow into vulnerability as an adult. We grow into the condition of being vulnerable as human beings. We open to that. And how we relate to that vulnerability is important. Through this process of giving the corners of the mind a space to breathe, we also start to see ourselves through different eyes, through eyes of compassion. Yeah. To actually to see the kind of that the innocence of our being, you know, like this very basic level of there's something just very innocent about our being. And in those moments when secrets became secrets, we were really out of touch with that innocence. We were really out of touch with a sense of safety. And so we start to provide some of that sense of safety to ourselves. And so through this process, we kind of logic of the Dharma unfolds, and we do, I believe, come to feel like there's less and less that needs to be hidden from others and from ourselves. And that kind of transparency and a kind of embrace of one's own vulnerability is actually maybe paradoxically creates a strong sense of safety and stability. And so the Dharma spreads, you know, it flows out into the corners. And I think as we actually feel more and more transparent to ourselves, the kinds of letting go that are asked in the depth of practice, that feels more natural. It feels more natural to let go into that, because there's some real courage that there's nothing we could find that would destroy us. So I'll stop. A few minutes if there's anything.
Thank you. Your talk tonight brought up a lot of thoughts and questions for me.
Yeah.
And I wanted to share a bit of my interpretation of what you were saying and get your thoughts on it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then also something that is a bit of a conflict. So as you talked about the concept of no secrets, what that brought up for me was the idea of being authentic.
Yeah.
Sure. The idea of being authentic.
Yeah.
And I've personally, over the last 6 months, had an effort in my life to be more authentic and have seen that it's improved the quality of my relationships,
yeah,
especially with people I'm close to. And I'm continuing in that effort. And so kind of one thought is, your thoughts on us, is that related to what you're talking about?
Yeah.
And then the second piece is, I've continued to struggle with the concept of not self.
Yeah.
We've talked about impermanence. And I think not self, to me, is almost in that concept and how it relates to what we're talking about with this introspection, because I think that to be authentic, you have to, I've had to take the time to really truly understand, what am I feeling, what am I thinking, what is at the core of it, and that's a lot of introspection and focus on yourself so you can put yourself forward, but that seems to be in conflict with this other concept. So.
Yeah. Yeah. The concept of not self is like useless, and just completely put that aside. Seriously, I mean, I wouldn't. I won't. I may not. That my answer might be different in 6 months, but right now, it's crossing the wires, and And it sounds like you're doing great. And it is, and practice sounds very rich. And that kind of exploration of like what is authentic? Like what? Who am I? You know what is the self? Who, you know, like what do I care about? Who, these kinds, and how can I actually show up in a relationships with close people in a way that feels authentic? Because people want that from us. They want that from you. And we, if we can give that to people, it's a very different level of connection, yeah? So that is part of, for sure, what I'm talking about transparency and being able to show up in an undefended way where it feels like there's less and less and less to hide. So I would keep following that thread, and you know the language around self and not self, it really does need to be cleaned up in the Dharma world, I think. And It'll have its time. It's related to what you're exploring, but it'll have its time and practice. Yeah. Thanks.
I've been thinking about this for a while now, and so this is a timely talk for me, but the whole concept of authenticity versus what you were talking about in the beginning, the privacy.
Yeah.
And how you navigate all of that.
Yeah. It's good to distinguish between secrecy and privacy, yeah? And so sometimes we may feel like we're being just private, but there's actually some flavor of secrecy bound up in it, yeah? And so that's a point to investigate. Like, why do I want to be private? Like, are there overtones of self-consciousness or something like that? That's a place to investigate for sure. But I do think people are on a spectrum of more or less private, you know, and probably that co-varies with their response to the NSA surveillance to some extent. I do think it's privacy is totally compatible with authenticity and connection. The question is sort of like, is our heart private? Is our, like, what's most meaningful to us private? That I think we want out there, you know? And that's the ground of connection. And so, yeah, maybe we can, if you have, it'd be good to get a little bit of specifics, and I'm happy to chat. Okay, so we've got to stop, but come on up, yeah. So let's just sit for a second. whatever goodness is here tonight in the room. May it remind you of your own goodness. And when we sense our own goodness, we naturally wish well for others. Naturally want to help. Maybe so. Thank you.